Jane Danska, can you tell me who you are?
I am a research scientist and at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada, and a member of the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto here. I run a research laboratory that is concerned with genetics and immunology in the context primarily of diseases that affect children.
Well, you know, it's quite a time to look at immunology in children because asthma is on the rise, autoimmune conditions are on the rise, autism may be an autoimmune condition. There's been an alarming rise of a number of autoimmune-related diseases.
That is a major part of the motivation for the study that we'll speak about today and for many studies that are going on now. That is to ask, what has changed in our environment that has led to this increase in immune-mediated diseases over the past 50 years or so? It's not our genes that change that fast, so it must be environmental.
And we have a number of strange environmental things that have happened. We have a cleaner environment. We have more chemicals that make estrogens in our environment as a side effect of the chemicals.
There are many, many changes in the environment. Because these diseases that we're speaking of today are mediated by the immune system, that has led to a strong interest in environmental components that we know provoke strong changes and effects on the immune system. And that has led to a focus on the microbes that colonize, particularly our intestine.
Well, that's right. You just did a study where you changed mice that were bred to be diabetic, type 1 diabetic mice. And you changed the kinds of gut microbes in the mice, and the female mice didn't get sick as often.
Yeah, this is a special strain of mouse, and they're all genetically identical to each other. Obviously, males and females have the different X and Y chromosomes, just like humans do. But other than that, they have all of the same genes. The females will progress spontaneously to have type 1 diabetes. About 90% of them will do so.
And that means that 90% of them will have an inflammatory process that kills their pancreas, the beta cells in their pancreas.
Absolutely, absolutely, just as we see in humans. But in the males of this same strain of mouse, only 35 to 40% of those animals get sick. So there's a sex difference in diabetes incidence in this strain of mouse.
Now, is this true also in humans with diabetes? Are more women prone to get diabetes, type 1 diabetes, than men are?
No. Diabetes, type 1 diabetes, is the exceptional autoimmune disease because it does not display a strong sex bias. In contrast, many other autoimmune diseases do display a strong sex bias, where females have a higher frequency of the disease than males.
All right, so if we think of things like rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis or lupus or skin conditions, those are things that women are more likely to have than men?
Absolutely. Those are all correct. And women definitely bear the greatest burden of immune-mediated diseases in the population. And it's estimated that 5 to 10% of women are managing some kind of immune-mediated problem.
Which means that somehow their immune system is confused and attacking their own body more often than it attacks the body of men.
I'm not sure whether it's confusion, I think we may be imposing a term there that might not fit, but clearly the female immune system is more prone to allowing an autoimmune condition or inflammatory condition than males. But you'd mentioned earlier autism. Now, autism, as you know, is more frequent in males than females, about 2 to 1. So we know very, very little about an inflammatory base for autism. But as you mentioned earlier, the frequency of the disease seems to be rising. But we don't really have strong information yet to link it to an immune-mediated component, although there could be one.
So we have these mysteries that you want to solve. And for looking at this issue of how gut microbes and sex hormones might affect autoimmunity, I'm curious why you chose a type 1 diabetic mouse.
Because we knew that the mice displayed this sex bias. So that was one feature that was interesting. Another feature that was interesting was that we know that the cleanliness of the housing conditions determine have a big impact on the frequency of type 1 diabetes in this mouse strain.
Interesting. So that if their cage is dirty, they get a different rate of diabetes than if their cage is super clean.
Yeah, and by that I mean if you look at the burden of bacterial and viral pathogens in the colony, these colonies are screened very carefully for these agents. A colony of these mice that has a higher burden of, for example, pathogenic viruses and bacteria will have a lower frequency of diabetes. And conversely, a cleaner colony that is free of all pathogenic microbes that we screen for has a higher frequency of diabetes. So we knew that the disease was influenced by hygiene status.
Well, Jane Danska, that fits with a lot of suppositions about the hygiene hypothesis, that our world is getting too clean, and that is actually making us sicker. And this is true for the mice as well.
In a sense, yes, because they have a very high genetic risk for this disease. But even in that setting, you can still see the effects of hygiene, of cleanliness, or exposure to microbes on the probability that they'll actually progress to get sick.
Now, these mice, these were the things you were curious about. What accounts for the sex difference? Why is it that the clean mice get sick more often than the dirty mice? And also you were wondering about how much gut microbes would make a difference.
Exactly. Those were all in our minds as we initiated these studies. And like most interesting science, you start with those interesting questions in mind and you find things you weren't looking for.
Well, what were you looking for and what surprised you?
The first simple question we asked was, if we take these diabetes-prone mice and we move them into an environment which is completely sterile, where they have no bacteria in their gut, no bacteria on their skin, et cetera, and it's a special kind of housing condition that we have to use. If we move them there into this absolutely sterile environment, what will happen to the frequency of diabetes in the mice? That was the first question we asked.
Well, let's look at that question because that's a little bit similar to what medical doctors do when they give somebody full-spectrum antibiotics. They try to clean out a lot of their germs so that they hope that they'll get better. And this was a more extreme version of that.
Very, very extreme, because even when we're treated with antibiotics, we're still left with some bacteria and viruses, of course. But what we observed was that the protection that males had relative to females for type 1 diabetes, the lower frequency of diabetes in the males, that went away when we put them in a sterile environment. So they were just as prone to the disease as the females were.
So you had thought that the males have some kind of sex hormone benefit that keeps them from getting diabetes, but when you took away all of their microbes, they lost that benefit.
That's right. They lost that benefit, and we immediately tested their testosterone levels exactly as you mentioned, and we were very surprised to see that in the absence of normal bacterial components of their gut, their testosterone levels were significantly lower than the same strain of mouse living with normal bacteria in their gut.
Did anybody know that sex hormones were that affected by gut microbes?
No, I, to our knowledge, this is the first recognition of that connection.
So if someone says, I have a gut feeling that my sex hormones are a little off, they may be right.
You never know.
Well, okay, so that was the first test that you did.
Then we asked, well, does that mean that in the normally colonized environment, the normal mouse house in which our animals live, does that mean that males and females have different communities of bacteria in their intestines? So it seemed a logical question. So then we evaluated that question using some modern methods. And here we had a terrific collaborators at the University of Colorado, both in Boulder and in Denver, with whom we did these aspects of the studies. And we looked to see what kinds of bacteria were resident in males and females. And we were very surprised to see that they were different.
Now, so I can picture this study correctly, do your male and female mice hang out together in the same cages, or do you have them in separate places?
They hang out together until they are weaned from their mother, which takes place at 3 weeks of age, and then they're moved into sex-separate cages. We put them back together, of course, when we want to breed them, but in the animals in this study, they weren't being bred. They were being kept housed as separate sexes once they were weaned.
Well, that tells me that you might not know yet what happens if you had them hanging out together like normal mice.
Yes, and we have not those. It's a very good question, and we haven't done those studies. I would not be surprised to find that when males and females are co-housed, for example, during breeding, that they're, maybe the microbiomes in their guts may be a little bit more similar to each other, but we haven't done those studies. We've just looked at the developmental change in males and females in their gut microbes, and we did it by looking at mice at 3 weeks, just at weaning, and we don't see any differences between males and females at 3 weeks of age.
So when they're co-housed?
Same mom, same litter, born in the same cage. And at 3 weeks of age, there's no difference between the males and the females. But by puberty and then full adulthood, we saw the emergence of different characteristics of the communities of microbes in the male and the female gut.
Okay, and so after they're weaned, the males are put in one kind of cage and the females are put in another cage. And then their sex hormones are becoming more strong. And so you have those two changes, that the females are away from the males, and also their sex hormones are developing differently.
Well, of course, because they're male and female, and so we know from studies over many decades that sex hormones develop differently in males and females, so that's what we expect to find. But what we didn't expect to find was that once we determined that after puberty, males and females had different communities of microbes living in their gut, we decided to transfer microbes from either adult male or adult female intestine into young females, just at weaning, and to ask what would be the consequences of giving this, and we gave this material just once orally to the animals, into their gut, into their stomach. And we asked what happened to the young females that had been treated at weaning either with adult male or with adult female gut bacteria.
Okay, so you inoculated them with a gut bacteria dose of either male gut bacteria or female gut bacteria when they were little tiny pups, little female mice pups. And when they got older, what happened?
The very striking thing that we saw, we had to age them for some time to view this, was that the weanling age females who had received the male bacteria were strongly protected from type 1 diabetes.
How often did you say these female mice tend to get diabetes?
85 to 90% of them.
What happened when they had the male gut bacteria inoculated into them at weaning? When they grew up, how many of them had type 1 diabetes?
20 to 25%.
You went from most of them getting type 1 diabetes by a long shot to most of them not getting it by a long shot.
Correct.
That's a big difference.
There are a number of other things that we can measure in these mice during the progression to type 1 diabetes. And in fact, these are also things that one measures in humans that are progressing to type 1 diabetes. And they include specific kinds of antibodies that are made against the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas.
Well, that's right. Somebody who may have type 1 diabetes can take a test, and if they have those antibodies, it means that their body is attacking the pancreas and killing the beta cells still. It's a sobering test because it means a lot of things are going wrong.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't absolutely show that the child, for example, will go on to type 1 diabetes, but that's frequently the outcome. So we were able to show that transferring the male bacteria, but not the female bacteria, into these weanling mice, transfer of the male bacteria, but not the female bacteria, blocked the production of these antibodies against the islets, and then also blocked the eventual progression to type 1 diabetes.
And so it blocked the attack against the islet cells that produce insulin in these mice.
Correct.
And how about the overall inflammatory process in those mice? Was it lower or higher?
Well, we were also able to view using microscopes the invasion or the inflammation of the pancreas itself by cells of the immune system. And that inflammation of the pancreas was also dramatically blocked by the transfer of these male-sourced gut bacteria.
These male-sourced gut bacteria that promote higher testosterone in the male mice better than if you just inject them with testosterone, it sounds like.
Well, I can't speak to that. We didn't do that experiment, and if we have time, we can speak of why it's a more complicated experiment than it sounds like on the face of it. But certainly, we were able to show that the male bacteria, when transferred into these females, provoked elevated levels of testosterone in the females that received that bacteria.
Was it abnormally high levels for females, the amount of testosterone, or was it just high normal for a female mouse?
It certainly was significantly higher than we measure in this strain of mouse, but it was still far lower than you see in the males of the strain.
How about in a mouse that's not bred for type 1 diabetes? How does the testosterone level for these male and female mice compare with regular mice?
The strain that we're working on is not unusual with reference to the amount of testosterone that males or females have. They're a fairly... Even though they get type 1 diabetes, they're a fairly normal strain of mice in most other ways.
Okay, so it was a somewhat higher than normal amount of testosterone that these type 1 diabetes mice were producing, but it seemed to be protective against type 1 diabetes for them.
Absolutely, it was protective. And the reason that we know that the testosterone itself was required for the protection against the disease is that we also did some experiments, just as we've been speaking of, where we transferred the male bacteria into the female mice, but we also gave the female mice a drug that blocks the activity of testosterone.
Oh yes, that flutamide drug that inhibits testosterone.
When we blocked the testosterone's function or action, we no longer saw the protection against diabetes. So that suggests that the effect of the transfer of bacteria on the testosterone in the females was one essential component to the protection against autoimmune disease. There could very well be other things that were happening as well, but we know that the testosterone was needed.
This is quite a lot to take in. If I was somebody who had, this is quite a lot to take in. I would guess that anyone who has type 1 diabetes looking at this study would wonder, gee, should I be taking testosterone injections? Should I be eating more yogurt that has lots of lactobacillus and other microbes in it?
Well, those are certainly very separate kinds of questions. There certainly is no reason to support giving testosterone to persons with type 1 diabetes for a variety of reasons. I don't think anything that we have discovered suggests that that's a good idea.
And there's nothing in the literature that indicates that this reduces the chance of getting type 1 diabetes or reducing its attack once it's happening.
I don't know of any literature that has attempted to use testosterone in the diabetes setting, and I don't think there would be any indication to use it at this time. You may know, type 1 diabetes in humans is not associated with a big sex bias like those many other autoimmune diseases are. That may be in part because many people that get type 1 diabetes get it before they go through puberty.
I wonder, since there is an increasing number of people who have type 1 diabetes as adults, if that will start to change, at least for the adult population. But we don't really know yet, do we?
Absolutely. It's a very interesting question, and it'll take some time to get that information, but it's possible.
But you're intrigued about this for a lot of autoimmune diseases where there is a sex bias, and women tend to get the autoimmune disease more often.
Absolutely. I mean, for systemic lupus and multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis, the skin diseases that you mentioned, autoimmunity against the thyroid. These are all far more common in females than males. And if there is potentially the opportunity to modify the intestinal bacteria of persons at risk for those diseases or who even have those diseases and realize some modest changes in their metabolism and perhaps even their testosterone levels, if it's protective against the disease process, it may be worth considering in the future.
There are many ways to change the microbial community in somebody's gut. How they eat, how they exercise, what kind of antibiotics they've taken, what kind of stress they're under, all of these can affect the gut microbiome.
We're just really at the beginning of our understanding of the profound and intimate way that we are living with bacteria in our bodies, and that ultimately the goal is to be partners with these bacteria. We are their partners. They help us to digest our food. They help to give us vitamins. They are, we now know over the past decade, essential in teaching and training our immune systems to develop properly. So they do an enormous amount for us. And we need to behave in such a way to benefit them as well.
And we seem to be doing some things that are not so nice to our microbes with some of our environmental changes. And one of them that comes to mind is that we do indeed have a lot of chemicals now in the world that mimic estrogens. And could there be a possibility that there's just too many of these and they're too junky form of estrogen and they may get in the way of how the immune system sorts out things and how the microbiome grows in their presence?
Yeah, I haven't done any work in that area. I know it is an area of interest in environmental sciences. And I'm sure it will continue to receive the attention that it's due, but I don't have any comment really on that area because I'm not an expert in it.
We know that soy and milk and sugar all affect our hormones in different ways. So food can make a big difference.
Food undoubtedly does, and some of these effects may come by the effect of diet on the gut microbiome. We know there's some very, very beautiful data over the last year or two that very clearly indicate that the nature of an animal's diet dramatically affects the microbiome, which is not surprising because those bacteria are living on the food we eat. We are providing all of the nourishment for them. And so it's likely that changes in our diet affect the microbiome, and in turn, that is having effects on our physiology.
You know, and I'm thinking right now about an experiment that happened at CU about something called hypertrophic cardiac myopathy, where the heart enlarges at an early age and is the thing that kills a lot of young athletes. There was a group of, I think it was mice, maybe rats, but they were rodents and they were bred for this condition. They were wanting to check on the sex differences between the rodents and how that affected hypertrophic cardiac myopathy, and especially the males. So they took them off of a soy feed, since that has a lot of estrogens in it, and they put them on a milk-based feed that has less estrogens in it. And guess what happened to the hypertrophic cardiac myopathy males?
Did it improve?
They stopped getting hypertrophic cardiac myopathy. It basically went away. And there was nothing else that they'd done with exercise, with different pharmaceutical approaches. Nothing had touched this, but this did.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of puzzles out there, and there's. Do you hear the resonance between that and what you're doing? Just
yeah, I'd be. I mean, the experiment I would want to do in that model, since they have this interesting dietary effect, would be to evaluate the changes that diet imposes on the microbiota in the guts of these animals.
That would be an interesting experiment. And we should probably point out that even though this works in rodents, we don't know how this would work in humans because we live longer. Our cells adapt and change differently, and we don't have quite the same body as a rodent.
Oh, definitely. And we have a very different digestive tract because they are herbivores and we're omnivores. So we have a different geometry, a different anatomy to our digestive tracts, and different food and diet and so forth. So there are many differences between humans and rodents, of course. The value of the rodent models, as you just described for the Colorado University study, is that you can really limit the number of variables that you're studying at one time. And this is so much more difficult to do in humans.
Yes, but from what you've seen, you're excited. And what do you want to do next?
So we're doing a number of things. We are trying to move forward to understand more about how changes in the gut microbiome provoke changes in sex hormones and in the immune system. And we're doing that in a number of ways. One of them is to try to move beyond evaluating the gut bacteria solely based on what kinds of species and families they occupy in the sort of space of bacteria on the planet, but to ask, what do they do?
Oh, okay. So because you have some charts. You have some charts that show that the mice that had less of the type 1 diabetes had more bacteriodites than the mice that had more type 1 diabetes. And so one could go through and say, well, I'm going to make a checklist and I'm going to use this bacteria and this bacteria and this bacteria, but it doesn't tell you the diversity of the community. It doesn't tell you how they interacted together.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think those are very important points. In most studies of ecology, particularly when it comes to microbes, there are many different combinations of microbes that can do well together in a given environment. So it suggests that that's really important is how they function as a group, what they do together as a group. And we're going to try to use some additional tools. And again, we're continuing our collaboration with our colleagues in Denver and in Boulder on these studies to determine not just what bacteria are they, for example, the specific type of bacteria you just mentioned, but what are they doing? What genes do they express? What do we predict the outcome of those genes would be in terms of the kinds of materials that the bacteria would make and secrete. So we're trying to move from sort of taking attendance of the community to understanding how the community functions.
Well, it sounds almost like an ecologist looking at the African savanna and saying, okay, this needs a lion and a cheetah and lots of antelope, and then looking at the plains of the United States and saying in wild areas you need some coyotes, and you need some badgers, and you need some white-tailed deer.
Mm-hmm. And lots of grasses to feed them all.
Yes, and then if you're in an Amazon forest, you might need more fruits and leaves, and anaconda. I don't know my Amazon forest very well, but you'd look for a different set to see how they function together successfully there.
Exactly.
And all of them would be fine as long as they had the right pieces for that environment.
Right. So I think what we ultimately want to get to is what is the core functionality, the core functions of a healthy human gut microbiome? What constitutes health? And then what kind of components can we transfer into individuals, obviously safely, that will help to encourage a healthy setting in that individual?
And not only transfer, but how do they maintain a healthy gut microbiota once they have it by how a person eats and exercises and stress?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's an important difference in thinking about probiotics, for example, that we consume in our milk products, which are probably very helpful. Those probiotics give us things that are probably quite beneficial, but they pass through.
Oh, you mean things like yogurt, if you eat an active yogurt that has live cultures in it.
Exactly. Those lactobacillus and all of the things we read on the labels of the yogurts, they don't actually colonize our gut. They pass through, and they probably give us very beneficial substances when they do. But this discussion we're having today is about provoking durable changes in the community of bacteria in the intestines of individuals. Things that will stay with them and continue to provide benefit.
I'm picturing the difference between putting a very pretty flower out on my patio in a pot versus figuring out some way to have a wild meadow where the grasses flourish and the flowers flourish all on their own because they balance each other so well that they grow on their own.
Absolutely. It's a good analogy.
Well, in all of this, we're talking about some hard work for you to figure out and also for people to do to take care of themselves in terms of attending to their lifestyle and their exercise and what they eat. Once the details get figured out about what to do, it sure would be easier if you would just say, couldn't we give these people a shot of testosterone and reduce their autoimmunity?
Yeah, there may be, I'm not an endocrinologist, but there may be ways to work around this whole bacterial community piece we've been discussing and just give hormones directly. There are always lots of concerns, of course, about giving hormones directly. It's not an easy thing to do. You want to make sure, as we saw in the mice, we raised the levels a bit, and that little bit was enough to provide incredible protection, but it still left the females able to breed normally, to nurse normally, and to have, as far as we could see, normal lives as female mice. So we don't want to move to a therapeutic approach that would prevent or make difficult for women with autoimmune diseases to have families by natural birth, should they choose to do so.
And then there's the example that you gave of the male mice who naturally produce testosterone, but when you took away all of their microbes, they didn't flourish. And in fact, their testosterone levels went down. So somehow or another, these hormones are balanced by having the healthy microbial community.
And since we know that that healthy community is providing so many other benefits to our bodies, it seems to me that it makes more sense to try to focus on understanding what components of the healthy microbiome are, how to categorize them, how to grow them in a consistent way, so that in time we'll be able to give them to individuals safely and generate lots of beneficial effects.
Well, thank you. Is there anything we've left out?
I just would want to make the plug for the fact that our study, and I think many of the studies that are allowing us to make progress in this field, are the key to them is the multidisciplinary, multiple kinds of expertise and collaboration among individuals. So although my lab organized these studies, we were greatly benefited by being able to collaborate with our genomics colleagues in Colorado, at Denver and in Boulder, with colleagues in Germany and Switzerland. And the coming together of individuals with different kinds of expertise to work together productively is what we need to make progress on these complicated areas of medicine.
And you know, there's another part of this collaboration that I wonder if you would speak an opinion about. Do you know about the American Gut Project?
I don't know about the American Gut Project.
This is something that Rob Knight, who's another microbiome pioneer,
Rob very well, yeah. I certainly know about the Human Microbiome Project, if that's what you're referring to. I don't know what the American one is.
You know, he has partnered with Jeff Leach, who has something called the Human Food Project, to have a crowdsourced funded study of what's in people's guts. And what they're doing is they got it cleared through the Human Review Board at CU Boulder to invite people to donate money. And in exchange, you can give a swab of, I think, your hand or the inside of your cheek or your poop. And you fill out a long questionnaire and you also sign on to an online food counter and say what you ate for a couple of days. You do all of this and you raise money for the research project. You get back information about what was in your microbiome sample and you get to fund this. You get to fund this. It's an interesting idea.
It's a great idea.
Was it easy to get your research funded?
It's never easy. We have multiple funders who've been key partners in all of this. The JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, which is the NIH equivalent here in Canada, our own institution, the Hospital for Sick Children. So it's not easy. One has to work hard, and peer review of your applications is always a rigorous process. But I think in that way, hopefully we get the best work done.
Well, good luck with what you're doing next. I hear you saying that it's too early to say what people should do if they have children who are at risk of type 1 diabetes, say the parents of a child with the parents, if one of them has type 1 diabetes already. A huge worry is, how do I reduce the chance that my child will get this too? There's not enough yet here to know.
Yes, we don't know enough yet to be able to determine what things might be protective. But I think that it's not that long in the future that we will be able to do careful, structured studies to test these ideas. But certainly anybody who has concerns that their child might be type 1 diabetic or wants to discuss it should source a good pediatrician to have that conversation and make sure that they get the right care and surveillance in place for their child.
And they might want to keep following studies like yours and think about them and hope that you do even more research real quick.
We hope so too. Thank you.